as the sound of the crickets filled the warm, dry night air. I uncomfortably tossed and turned in bed. Was it the warmth that was keeping me awake? Or was it the fact that Rwanda was again on a knife's edge? The two main tribes in our country have been at each other's throats for decades, and I couldn't help but feel the palpable tension blanketing the capital, Kigali. Surely the violence that plagued the country in 1990 couldn't return. Surely the ceasefire signed by President Habyarimana would hold. But as my eyes begin to get heavy and I drift off to sleep, I remember seeing the calendar on the wall. Tomorrow was the 6th of April 1994, the day our country plummeted into the depths of hell for 100 days. Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Dark History Podcast, where we explore the darkest parts of human history. Hope everybody is well. I'm Rob, your host as always. Just a quick thank you to you all for helping the show hit 50,000 downloads. When I started this just over a year ago, I never thought I would hit that mark. And that is all down to you guys, so thank you. In today's episode, we will discuss the Rwandan genocide. One of the most brutal and devastating events that happened to a country in modern history. I'm going to try to explain it as if I was there myself at the time. This would be a tough episode to talk about. There is a lot of suffering and despair attached to this one, so please keep that in mind when you listen. So without further ado, please sit back and relax next to the fire for more dark history. I woke to the sound of the buzz of the city. The smell of the earth was in the air due to the rain through the early morning. I remember I turned on my radio and the sound jumped out at me, with the vile Hutu intolerance calling for Tutsi cockroaches and snakes to be murdered. The feeling from the night before washed over me again. Why did today feel like our world would change? For as long as I could remember, my tribe, the Tutsis, had been discriminated against by the ruling Hutus. But it hadn't always been this way. The country had changed massively in the more recent decades. But to tell you that story, I must go back in time. My grandfather told me of the time when the Hutus rose up. The Hutus were angered by centuries of the Tutsi monarchy. A monarchy that was mostly the puppet of the Belgian colonists, and had a lot of pro-Tutsi and anti-Hutu policies. In 1945, the Hutus had grown a sizeable elite in the country, and called for the transfer of power from one tribe to the other. Of course, we, the Tutsis, wanted to hold power as long as possible, but those backstabbing colonists and the Catholic Church sided with the Hutus. In November of 1959, chaos ensued. Riots and arson attacks on Tutsi homes following the attack of one of the few Hutu sub-chiefs, Dominique Mbonyumutwa, by Tutsi extremists. Violence quickly spread throughout the country. The king and Tutsi politicians attempted a counter-attack to seize power and ostracize the Hutus and the Belgians, but they were thwarted by Belgian colonist Guy Logiest, who was brought in by the colonial governor. Logiest re-established law and order, beginning a program to promote and protect the Hutu elite. The Belgians then replaced many Tutsi chiefs and sub-chiefs with Hutus, consigning King Kigali V to figurehead status, but Kigali would later flee the country. Despite continued anti-Tutsi violence, Belgium organised local elections in mid-1960. Hutu parties gained control of nearly all of the communes, effectively ending the revolution. Logiest and the Hutu leader Grégory Kayibanda declared Rwanda an autonomous republic in 1961, and the country became independent in 1962. This caused 300,000 of my tribe to flee our country to Uganda and others. Armed groups of Tutsis did try to fight back from these countries, and the biggest being in 1963, when the Tutsis unleashed a surprise attack on the Hutu government in Kigali. Unfortunately, they fought back and killed the rebels, and thousands of innocent Tutsis still inside of Rwanda. Even though peace had come to Rwanda in 1963, the early period of Hutu government had internal struggles, until in 1973, when senior army commander Juvenal Habyarimana organised a coup, killing President Kayibanda and assuming the presidency. By 1990, the Tutsi refugees had more than outstayed their welcome in Uganda. Ugandan ranch owners forced squatters on their land, many of whom were Rwandans, to leave. This led to a wider debate on indigeneity, and eventually to the explicit labelling of all Rwandan refugees as non-citizens. Realising their position, the Rwandan Patriotic Force, or RPF if you will, devised a plan to invade northern Rwanda. On October the 1st, 1990, the Rwandan Civil War began, thus pitting Hutu and Tutsi against each other again. Unfortunately, it did not go well. The RPF leader was killed just 2 days into the fighting, and the army of Rwanda, helped out by the French, largely defeated the RPF by the end of October. With the RPF back to the wall, a new commander came to take control, pushing his forces into the mountains and beginning a furious guerrilla war campaign, which continued until mid-1992, with neither side being able to gain the upper hand. A series of protests forced Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana to begin peace negotiations with the RPF and domestic opposition parties. Despite disruptions, killings by Hutus, and a fresh RPF offensive in early 1993, the negotiations were successfully concluded with the signing of the Arusha Accords in August of 1993. An uneasy peace stuttered through Rwanda. Tutsi and Hutu again shared the land in which so much blood had been spilled. RPF troops were deployed to compounds in Kigali, and the peacekeeping United Nations Assistant Mission for Rwanda was sent to the country. But this uneasy peace wouldn't last. On the morning of April the 6th, 1994, the city of Kigali was awash with trepidation. Tensions between the two tribes were reaching fever pitch. It felt like one event would tip the scales and plunge Rwanda back into the destruction. The wait wouldn't be long. The assassination of Hutu President Juvenal Habyarimana and the Burundian President Cyprien Ntaryamira, who was also a Hutu, became the catalyst for hell on earth. The presidential jet was circling the busy streets of Kigali. At 8:20 p.m, it made its final descent into the district where the airport and the presidential palace were situated. Out of nowhere, a surface-to-air missile ripped through the clear night sky, colliding with the jet's wing. Moments later, a second missile took flight, administering the fateful blow to the tail of the aircraft. As flames engulfed the stricken jet, it crashed into the presidential gardens, and finally, exploded. Both presidents were dead, along with senior members of both countries' governments, and the three French members of the crew. This act caused utter chaos on the ground. Belgians, Rwandans, and UN soldiers were running around. People were being held at gunpoint, and there were faint whispers of an RPF attack on the president. These whispers would grow into a crescendo of noise vilifying the Tutsis over the coming hours and days. The acts on the 6th of April 1994 would spark a torrent of blood. That very night, the Presidential Guard, together with members of Rwandan Armed Forces and the Hutu militia group known as Interahamwe, set up roadblocks and barricades and began slaughtering Tutsis and moderate Hutus with impunity. Among the first victims of the genocide was the moderate Hutu Prime Minister, Agathe Uwilingiyimana, and 10 Belgian peacekeepers, who were killed on April the 7th. This would cause the Belgians to remove their troops and force the UN peacekeepers into policies to defend themselves only. All of this created a power vacuum as the government creaked and crumbled under the weight of the Hutu extremists. Fears grew as people fled for their lives through the streets and alleyways of the burning city. The safety and solitude of their homes defiled as Interahamwe dragged the people into the streets and mutilated them with axes and machetes, fires burning everywhere, and a scene that must have resembled the apocalypse. Grenades and gunfire echoed through the urban landscape as people fought not knowing who they were fighting. The violence escalated further, spilling out of Kigali and flooding the country. The 7th of April saw the RPF retake their arms and commence fighting with the Rwandan army and the Hutu militia. But as the frenzied claws of death spread throughout the countries, Tutsis and moderate Hutus were being slaughtered in towns and villages everywhere. Men, women and children butchered near and far, left to decay in the April sun, strewn across streets, gardens and in their homes. The Interahamwe showed no mercy, but this Hutu militia wasn't just comprised of men. It's estimated 96,000 women also took part in the genocide. In the first 4 days of fighting, 20,000 people were killed. And as Tutsis sought solace in churches, hospitals, schools, sports stadia and community centres, the Hutu paramilitaries and the Interahamwe began to target them. At the Unyarubai Catholic Church, Tutsis arrived from various places where killings had already started. Most of these people entered the church, and others went to join family in the area. By the evening of April 13th, the paramilitaries and the militia attacked from various points, armed with guns, machetes, swords, grenades and other things, and other traditional weapons. Having surrounded the area, they launched an assault on the church, systematically killing Tutsis over several hours. They first led with the paramilitaries, with the guns and the grenades, which was followed up by a large number of Interahamwe killers. The following day, the bodies would be sprayed with pepper spray to determine if any were still alive. If so, they were to be killed. The levels of violence were significantly high at this massacre, even for the context of the overall genocide. In the bathrooms belonging to the nuns, girls were raped and pregnant women had their stomachs opened up prior to killing them, and the fetuses were then thrown in the toilets. Prior to killing some of the girls and women, they would first penetrate them through the vagina with sharpened pieces of wood. Children were smashed against walls, killing them instantly. Other symbolic actions designed to dehumanize those about to die took place. The monument of the Virgin Mary was destroyed because she looked like a Tutsi. Symbolically destroying the monuments meant that God had abandoned the Tutsis, As the killers beheaded the Tutsis with their machetes, they poured the blood into imivieur, which is a traditional receptacle, shouting, "May the blood of Tutsis become the milk that they are fond of." Of the 35,000 people inside of that church, 18 survived. But this wasn't an isolated massacre. Another of these heinous acts happened within a church and the concrete terraces of the Kibai football stadium. The first massacre occurred at the St. Jean Catholic Church and home complex, which sits on a piece of land surrounded on three sides by Lake Kivu. By April 17th, thousands of unarmed men, women and children, predominantly Tutsis, had taken refuge there. Using guns, grenades, machetes, spears, cudgels and other weapons, members of the paramilitary, the police from the commune of Gitsi, the Interahamwe fighters and armed civilians attacked and killed those who had gathered. The second massacre happened in the Gatwaro Stadium, located on the main road in Kibai. As with people who had gathered in the St. Jean Church and home complex, those who congregated at the stadium were told to go there by the government officials. Once there, they were not allowed to leave. Without food or water, the captives ate grass. On April the 18th, the paramilitaries, police, Interahamwe fighters and armed civilians surrounded the stadium. A gunshot in the air initiated the massacre, and thousands were killed that day. The next morning, the attackers returned and killed any who had survived. I cannot begin to describe the shocking devastation that was commonly found throughout Rwanda by April the 28th. As 2,500 Tutsis fled through the country to the border with Tanzania, their route would have been littered with the shredded blood-stained clothes of corpses. Their mothers, fathers, brothers and sisters laying where they fell. The stench of death and decay would have been unbearable. Announcements over the radio would still blur out calling for the deaths of Tutsis as government-backed propaganda whipped the marauding bands of Hutus into murderous frenzy. The government forces by now encouraging normal citizens, not aligned with any militia, to take up arms and kill their neighbours and friends. If they refused, they were targeted too. Within this deep cloud of blood-soaked darkness, there were also acts of great bravery. Sula Karuhimbi was an elderly woman who lived alone on a small farm and had knowledge of natural medicine. When the genocide began, she hid more than 20 Tutsis in her animal shed and fed them from her small stock of vegetables. When attackers came to her farm, she used her reputation as a witch to frighten them off and protect the people hiding. Following the death of her uncle and cousin, Bita Umwazinika fled to the house of a neighbour, Yahanya. He refused to allow the Interahamwe into his home to murder Bita, despite the risk of himself being killed. Yahaya was a Muslim who said that the Quran, it states, if you save one life, it saves the world entirely. Others, such as Jean-Louis Mazimpika, survived by hiding in their towns or by escaping to the Congo, where there were refugee camps. These camps also posed dangers, as Hutus deliberately targeted them, knowing that Tutsis sought safety in them. Some survived because their attackers believed them dead. Daphrose Makangarambi was married with 5 children. She was beaten and finally hit with a machete on her forehead. Before she lost consciousness, she saw her baby murdered by a neighbour and his dog taking the body. Daphrose was the only member of her family to survive the genocide. These acts of heroism would be few and far between. The violence and bloodshed had already taken its toll on the country. In the 100 days of the genocide, over 1 million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were murdered. Many more were maimed and scarred for life. The United Nations reported that at least 250,000 women and girls were raped, and of those who survived the genocide, 67% were estimated to have contracted HIV/AIDS. In many cases, this resulted from the systematic and deliberate use of rape by HIV-positive men as a weapon for genocide. Up to 20,000 children were born after the genocide as a result of rape. Hundreds of thousands of children were left orphaned after the genocide. Many more children lived on the streets, not able to access education, and forming groups in which older children looked after the younger ones. Around 75% of the Tutsi population was murdered during the genocide, leaving a much reduced population surviving and attempting to rebuild their lives. On the 17th of July, the RPF troops reached the capital, and the genocide was finally over. The RPF now occupied the majority of Rwanda, and immediately established a new government, based loosely on the Arusha Accords. Pasteur Bizimungu, a moderate Hutu who had joined the RPF in 1990, was declared the president, with Paul Kagame, commander of the RPF, as vice president. Kagame took over the presidency in 2000, and he has remained in power since. The post-genocide period was a difficult one for Rwanda. The country lost a significant number of its population in a short amount of time, and it struggled to rebuild its infrastructure afterwards. In the years that followed the genocide, the country did make significant progress. Rwanda established a court system and began to process and bring in perpetrators of the genocide to justice. It also implemented various reforms to improve the country's economic and social stability. There was another isolated massacre that happened in 1995 in the Kibeho refugee camp. Not long after 10 a.m. in heavy rain, Hutu forces began firing into a crowd in the hospital compound, causing a stampede of refugees against razor wire and barricades. The forces continued to fire at fleeing refugees for the next 2 hours. While initially firing into the mass crowd with rifles, the Hutus later began using 60mm mortars. As a result, 4,200 people had been killed, with a further 400 to 500 people unaccounted for. Even now, Rwanda is still dealing with the legacy of the genocide. Many survivors still suffer the psychological trauma, and the country continues to face ethnic tensions. Nevertheless, Rwanda is committed to rebuilding and creating a better future. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to listen to this quite hard episode. It's hard to think how many people could just switch and descend into the most animalistic creatures on the planet. I've researched these kinds of stories over 2 years now for various bits of content, and the Rwandan genocide always turns me cold. Seeing the pictures or video footage of this is utterly harrowing. The justice system in Rwanda has something like 1 million people to prosecute who actively were culpable for the genocide. To put that into perspective, that is 1/5 of the country's entire population that raped or murdered people, of which of this 100,000 were jailed for their crimes. The other 900,000 people walk free. Could you imagine living in the same community as a person that might have wiped out your whole family? Murdered your mother, father, son, daughter, etc. Even now you read stories of Tutsi people who have lived next door to Hutus who did actually wipe out their entire families. How can you begin to rebuild your life after that? This conflict didn't just stay contained within Rwanda. It leaked out into Congo as Hutu refugees entered the country and threatened to come back to Rwanda to begin the genocide again. This in turn forced the RPF into war with Congo in 1996 and 1998, and the country of Congo has never really recovered. Anyway, if you liked the episode, please drop us a review. It helps the podcast out. If you think friends and family may like it, then share it with them. Links to all socials are below. I've recently set up a Patreon. This is a place where you can come and support the show. We have two tiers, one at £2 per month, and this gets you the back catalogue, all ad-free, plus access to script and show notes. The second tier is £5 a month. It gets all of the above, and Patreon-only episodes, which will be me finding a horror story or a dark tale from your hometown, or whichever town you want. I hope you will be able to support the show, but if not, that is completely fine. As always, if you've been listening for a while not subscribed, please do that and you will never miss an episode. So with all that out the way, thank you again for listening. Join us next time for episode 9 as we delve into another event and more dark history.